Welcome to part two of the 2013 Community Voices special. I'm Sarah Buckingham, the Community Voices Coordinator at WYSO. This hour, we'll hear stories produced in WYSO's 2013 Community Voices training course. We'll meet a young man trying to beat the odds, get some history on the Dayton Dragons, meet members of the area polyamorous community, and more. If you missed the first hour of our special, you can find it online at wyso.org. Just click the Community Voices tab. And while you're there, you can sign up for our mailing list to receive updates on future trainings. Community Voices is heading into its fourth year. We've trained college students, public school teachers, and people from all walks of life. Our goal is to turn listeners into producers and get more local voices on the air. The annual six-month training course is just one part of Community Voices. Another spoke in the ComVox wheel is the Civil Rights Oral History Project, a volunteer-led effort in Yellow Springs. WYSO holds a rich digital archive from the Civil Rights era, and as we approach the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act in 2014, we're partnering with community organizations to augment that archival audio with the stories of local residents who lived through this transformational period in our history. Community Voices producer Jocelyn Robinson used the historical audio to inspire childhood recollections of the day when the streets of Yellow Springs looked more like the streets of Birmingham, Alabama.
We shall overcome. We shall overcome.
You're hearing archival audio recorded by WYSO News in September of 1963. It's Antioch College music professor Walter Anderson leading Yellow Springs residents in We Shall Overcome, the anthem of the civil rights movement. Over 400 people had marched through the village to mourn four little girls killed in a Southern church bombing and to strengthen their resolve to integrate a downtown barbershop.
We shall overcome someday.
In the weeks after the march, local protests were escalating in front of Lou Gegner's barbershop. WYSO News aired a special report that captured events as they happened.
All five demonstrators kept picketing, so Sheriff Bradley read the injunction.
And if you would cut the pickets to four, there will not be any arrests made. However, if this is not done, I have no other alternative.
The local civil rights demonstrators sang We Shall Overcome, the battle hymn of the integration movement. The National Association for the Advancement of White People countered with God Bless America. When no one dropped out of the picket line, all five demonstrators were arrested. They were loaded into a Yellow Springs police car for the trip to the Greene County Jail in Xenia.
Demonstrations continued, and on March 14, 1964, villagers and Antioch students were joined by students from nearby Central State and Wilberforce colleges. Hundreds of people lined the streets of Yellow Springs to bear witness to what was about to happen. Sterling Wright was a young teenager, and Bomani Moyendo was only 10 years old. Sterling, then Bomani, shared their memories of that day.
So I remember getting up in the morning and my parents telling me, don't go downtown because there's going to be problems. But I was 13 at the time. And myself and a lot of our friends were going to go down there anyway out of curiosity.
But I remember my mother taking my sister and I down there that day and standing and watching, and the students linked arm in arm, you know, across the street. I wasn't exactly sure what was going on, but I knew it was about this white man who refused to serve black customers.
So as we approached the town, me and a few of my friends, we started talking, and we were very well aware of what was going on in the United States. The demonstrations, the freedom riders, the lynchings, we were very, very well aware, and were very shocked that that could happen here in our hometown.
To see that many people occupying downtown and tension that was in the air, you know, to sense that and to hear the singing and the shouts of the protesters, you know, it was really intense.
It was so intense that officers in riot gear used nightsticks and fire hoses to break up the demonstrators. Villagers watching from the sidewalks fled, blinded and choking as tear gas billowed through the crowd. Abandoning nonviolence, some protesters actively resisted arrest, and over 100 people were hauled off to jail. Years of insistent but peaceful protests ended up in a race riot that was carried on the national evening news. The barber closed the shop that day, never to reopen, never to integrate. But the movement marched on. That summer, busloads of volunteers from all over the country headed for Mississippi to open freedom schools and register black voters. Congress passed the Civil Rights Bill in June, making integration the law of the land. The following spring, the drum major of the movement gave the commencement address at Antioch College, and the speech was taped by a WYSO reporter.
Those of us who live in the 20th century are privileged to live in one of the most momentous periods of human history. Indeed, we find ourselves standing between two ages. The dying old and the emerging new. An old age is passing away, and a new age is coming into being.
Now, nearly 50 years into the new age, Yellow Springs is considered a liberal haven in conservative Southwest Ohio. Yet many current residents have no knowledge of its civil rights legacy, no memory of its role in our nation's struggle for equality. Robin Jordan Henry, a member of the 365 Project, one of WYSO's partners in collecting oral histories to enhance the historical recordings, explains the importance of gathering and preserving stories like those of Sterling and Bomani.
We need their stories because we need to understand this village. We need to understand what people have gone through in order to make this village what it is now, or even keep working to make this village what it ought to be, what it purports itself to be. And also just for a more realistic view of who this village is.
Eventually, WYSO's archives and the oral histories will be available to researchers and scholars. But memories of pivotal events in our history belong to all of us. It's our shared story, whether you lived through it or not. And it shapes the character of our community, past, present, and future.
People should kind of use that incident as an anchor and really focus on the values that were present during that time, the values of social and racial justice, and really use that history and energy to focus on doing some anti-racism work on a personal level.
I think that going forward, if you forget the past, you have no future. I think that Yellow Springs is a sleeping giant. I do believe that the new community that moved here because of the good things that they wanted to see, that if we can charge them socially, that we can make some major changes here.
Hallelujah. For WYSO Community Voices and the Civil Rights Oral History Project, this is Jocelyn Robinson. Yeah.
In our next story, a group of people you may not have heard about fighting for rights today. A new way of thinking about relationships is growing in the U.S. Polyamory is the ability to have romantic love for more than one person at a time. And Dayton is home to a growing polyamorous community. A local group called Southwest Ohio Young and Poly was formed in response. Community Voices producer Nicole Richter takes us to a poly potluck.
This is not a story about swingers, religion, or cheating. This is a story about love. We're at the Southwest Ohio Young and Poly Monthly Potluck. There are children running around, folks having conversations, and lots of food on the table. Here, families and friends join together in a celebration of community. Since the group was formed a year and a half ago, it has grown to over 150 members. Jason, Brianna, and Keely run Southwest Ohio Young and Poly. Together, they form a triad.
I live in a household with two other partners, Brianna and Jason. We live in a triad, which means we all have fully developed romantic relationships with each other.
This is just one of several relationship structures in polyamory. Other structures include a V, where two of three people in a relationship are dating one another, or a quad, where four people date one another romantically. Jason explains how the triad works.
We are a whole. When I'm thinking about making a choice or taking an action, I don't think about, is this good or bad for Keely? Is this good or bad for Bree? I think, is this good or bad for the triad, for our family? I see us as a unit, and I wish the world could see us as a unit.
When first hearing about polyamory, many people wonder about jealousy. The triad explained to me that jealousy is an emotion often based in fear. In order to be successful in polyamory, you have to be willing to confront your own insecurities. Here's Jason again.
The three principles of successful, ethical non-monogamy, period, especially polyamory, is communicate, communicate, communicate. If you are open and honest with your wants and needs, open and honest and willing to listen to the wants and needs of your partners, you will be successful. If you can't put them before yourself, then you probably won't be successful, but you probably won't be successful at monogamy either.
Jason and Brianna have been dating for 3.5 years. Keely met Jason and Brianna at her first potluck, and the triad has been happily dating for a year. Together, they have 4 children between the three of them. Here's Brianna and Jason again.
I am by nature polyamorous. I believe that in my core, more than one partner is the best path for my happiness, because I believe that I shouldn't count on one person to fulfill all my needs. And that's why I have partners who are different, who fulfill different aspects of what my soul needs.
We are energized by the love we all share, and it inspires us to find adventures, follow whimsy, and go on road trips, and end up stuck in Indianapolis in the middle of a blizzard because we didn't pay attention to the weather at Christmas time. Things like that. It inspires us because we're so genuinely happy and comfortable together.
This alternative relationship structure has practical benefits as well, especially for parents trying to juggle multiple household responsibilities.
There are splits in the family duties that are incredibly beneficial. I hate taking out the trash, and I don't have to do that anymore. You know, I hate doing laundry. I don't have to do that anymore. But I can organize like no one's business, and I get to do that because we have a large and complicated household that needs to be organized.
Coming home to a household where I know I don't have to do everything every day, where I have partners who love and support me, I have more resources to go to, more people that I know have my best interests at heart.
In the end, it is really about the love that the three share for one another.
I definitely think I'm the luckiest guy in the world, but I get a fair share of comments the other way of people, especially people who are in monogamous, not so happy relationships who go, how can you deal with 2 women at once? So there's a lot of fringe benefits, and it's not the ones people would expect. It's the great peace of just the three of us curling up together and watching shows we all enjoy, and having one of them on each side of me holding my hand while we watch TV. And it allows us to build this home together, to build a family. Family is very important to me, and feeling like somewhere is home.
Something exciting is happening to the triad. Here's Jason and Brianna.
I asked her formally to marry me.
And it made me cry, but that's not that difficult to do.
Made me cry, which isn't that difficult to do.
Brianna has a romantic fairy tale approach to love, while Keely is more grounded and practical. Keely is fully supportive of Jason and Brianna's engagement and is happy when her partners are happy. For her, love is not about possession, it is about joy. As an affirmation of her love for the 2 people she cares most about, Keely went with Jason to pick out the ring for Brianna.
Keely kept pointing at different rings, and then the woman who sold it to them said, well, don't you want to try it on? And Keely said, no, it's not for me. And I can only imagine the look that woman must have had at that moment. But I feel completely surrounded by love.
I think everybody feels jealousy. I think the longer we're together, at least for me, the less I feel jealous of their relationship, because their relationship being strong benefits my bonds with both of them and the feelings in our home. So it's hard to feel jealous when your partners are happy together.
There is a name for this feeling Keely is describing. It's called compersion. It is sort of like the opposite of jealousy. Brianna and Keely explain.
Oh, compersion is a wonderful feeling. Compersion is the joy that you feel because your partner is having fun with someone else. Any parent knows the feeling of compersion incredibly well.
Anytime anything wonderful happens to your child or you see them happy, even if you didn't make them happy, you're happy for them.
Yeah.
They want to get married as a triad, but the law will not allow that. In the meantime, they're working on a private ceremony to unite the three of them to recognize their commitment to one another.
I definitely consider a civil rights struggle as the gay marriage movement goes on. It seems to be opening the door for poly to become much more prevalent in the mainstream, and the legal issues will have to be dealt with. We face a lot of the same issues of, if I died tomorrow, who will inherit my house that we all three share?
While the triad faces obstacles socially and legally, they feel there is a growing understanding of alternate relationship styles.
There will always be members of society who don't accept anything that is outside of their definition of normal. There will always be people who stand against me, but I also understand that there are more and more people who stand behind me every day.
For WYSO's Community Voices, this is Dr. Nicole Richter.
A different kind of love story now. This one about the city of Dayton and its minor league baseball team, the Dragons. Early in the 2014 baseball season, the Dayton Dragons will sell out their 1,000th consecutive ball game at home, a record in North American professional sports. There hasn't been an unsold ticket for a Dragons game since 2000. That's the year the Dragons played for the first time in the $23 million stadium built for them by the city. Stephen Siff is a journalism professor at Miami University, and he worked with two of his students, Chris Cullum and Kathleen Sullivan, to bring us the story of Dayton's love for these Dragons and why it almost never came to be.
There's an electric, there's a vibe that happens downtown on the streets that you can feel it. You can feel the summer coming, feel the spring coming, baseball's happening, and it's just, it's electric. It's really awesome. It's hard to describe. It just is a feeling every year. It's like a freight train coming in the wintertime. You can't wait for baseball, can't wait for that activity downtown. It just changes the mood and the atmosphere of everybody downtown.
That's Chris Bahai, the manager of Brick's Ice Company, a restaurant and bar across the street from Dayton's Dragon Stadium, 5th 3rd Field, in an area of industrial buildings and brick warehouses. Like much of downtown, it is mostly empty at night, except when the Dragons play at home. Then you will see people on the sidewalks, cars on the streets, and hear cheering in the air.
I've heard all kinds of things such as, like, lifesaver, godsend, couldn't have survived without it. Just amazing things that some of the fans have said.
Before 5th 3rd Field opened, Dayton was one of the three largest cities in the country without a minor league baseball team. Not because Dayton didn't care about baseball. Since the 1880s, the roster of minor league teams that called Dayton home included the Gem Cities, the Reds, the Old Soldiers, the Veterans, the Aviators, the Marcos, and the Dayton Ducks. The Dayton Indians won the Central League championship, then folded, despite strong attendance, when their league disbanded in 1951. When City Commissioner Tony Capizzi began pushing for a new minor league team and stadium 40 years later, even the memories of baseball in Dayton had disappeared. Capizzi is now Montgomery County Juvenile Court Judge.
I couldn't believe there wasn't a baseball team here. There wasn't something to do in the summertime except go to Cincinnati to watch the Reds if you really wanted professional baseball, or Columbus. And I really felt there was Daytonians love baseball. You know, we're a UD basketball fan, we're a Wright State basketball fan, but I think people in Dayton really love baseball. And I could tell from looking at the numbers, we knew exactly how many people were out of Dayton area, the greater Dayton area, Miami Valley, were going to see Cincinnati Red games. And I felt strongly that if we could convince those people that we had a good product here, beautiful facility, cheaper price tickets, they could afford to bring their family. Because frankly, unless you're very well off, tickets to Cincinnati games are pretty over the head of most people. You got to spend $100 just to take a family of four to a Reds game to sit way, way back. You could spend $100 at a Dragons game and have almost front row seats. Big difference.
Capizzi's vision was for a downtown stadium. He believed it would draw the greatest crowds and spur the most economic growth. As the proposal gained steam, alternatives emerged to put a minor league team at Wright State University and other spots outside the downtown core.
Remember, this was happening in the 90s, and major, major facilities have been shutting down. So I do think that people were afraid to take a risk. Dayton's a great place to live, a great place to raise a family, great place to have a business, but so many people in Dayton at times seem so negative about that. So when I brought up bringing baseball to Dayton, 90% of what I heard was the negative side of it. Commissioner, it won't work because. And I kept on saying, let's find a way to make it work. That's what we're creative about. We can find a way to make it work. Let's just look at it in a positive way. So that in itself was a challenge to get people to think there was the possibility it could work and be successful.
One Daytonian wrote to the local newspaper, "This is the dumbest idea to waste tax money to come around in a long time." Who would pay to watch minor league baseball in Dayton anyway, when Cincinnati and the Cincinnati Reds were only an hour away? There was one person in particular who needed to be convinced. The controlling owner of the Cincinnati Reds, Marge Schott, was dead set against a baseball team in Dayton. Organized baseball gave her veto power over any minor league teams within her market. A Dayton team would just about have to be a farm team for the Reds, and the only way Schott would allow it was if she believed the Dayton team would sell more, not fewer, tickets for the Cincinnati Reds.
Her office, I thought it would be this beautiful new presidential office. It was nasty. It looked like it had been built when the stadium was built and never renovated. On the back wall behind me, there was a Coke machine where you had to put money in to get your Cokes out. And it had like those little 7-ounce bottles of Coke in it. And she asked me if I wanted a drink, and I said, sure. She goes, there's a pop machine behind you. And I had to take out money to put in to get my pop. So that was Marge. I'll never forget it.
Schott signed off on the plan.
We know our baseball here. We grew up with the Cincinnati Reds being the oldest team in sports. We were here for all the milestones. To get the Dragons, a single-A affiliate of the Reds, just is an extension of that. And so we're going to support our local home teams.
The stadium the city ultimately built for the Dragons is very nice. It has antique-looking wrought iron fences and brickwork. Game night may include a portable petting zoo, frisbee-catching stunt dogs, face painters, balloon animals, and a middle school student singing the national anthem. Kids love it. Tony Dunlap takes his 5-year-old son to nearly every home game.
I have 2 full-time jobs going on between my son and Pizza Hut. Our little escape is the Dayton Dragons games.
Although Dragons games sell out, advance tickets can usually be purchased online or through various promotions. For WYSO, I'm Stephen Siff.
You're listening to part 2 of WYSO's 2013 Community Voices Special, radio stories by, for, and about the Miami Valley, produced in this year's training course. I'm Sarah Buckingham, the Community Voices Coordinator. The United States has one of the most uncommon mixtures of cultures in the world, and in our next story, Vanita Kelly wonders, are we afraid of our multiculturalism, or is it the foundation of our lives? Does cultural heritage matter to Americans?
People are enthusiastic about revealing the reasons they are who they are, why they understand events in the way they do, and why they do what they do, if we ask with an ear to learn. What is your culture and how do you demonstrate it every day?
What is my culture?
You can definitely tell if someone was raised here.
I think like many of us, I demonstrate my culture in many ways, whether it's my dress, my attitude, the way I carry myself, my language.
This is quite a question.
You know, I think there are so many things about my culture that I feel like I'm only beginning to discover and really celebrate.
That's a deep question. You can talk for hours on that. You can tell a life story answering that question.
You sure you want?
Paul C. Brown is the Workforce Development Coordinator for GreenWorks in the Ohio Department of Jobs and Family Services. He began his answer to the culture question with this.
Well, I'm a first-generation American. The reason I say that is because my mother is a native Panamanian. She was born and raised in the Republic of Panama. At a young age, as she was, At that time, she was a professional woman, which was a little bit unusual for the 50s. We had what they called the nuclear family. My father and mother both worked.
Paul grew up in Chicago, the child of a caramel-skinned Panamanian mother and a black-skinned American Indian father.
But I just like the first-generation title because of the fact that I identify a lot more with my mother's culture because of the way I came up and the fact that once my grandmother, who raised us, came up here, she would still go back and forth to Panama every few years. And when I was young, she'd take myself and my younger brother with her.
He says the differences between the two countries led his own understanding of people.
My grandparents down there, they lived to older ages. It was nothing to see some of my uncles in their 70s and 80s still working every day. They were quite healthy. They were healthy people, but it was a cultural difference that I noticed at an early age, and now that I've gotten older, I appreciate the fact that I've known that because I think it has helped me to understand human nature and in a different way.
What do you understand about human nature because of how you came up?
Now, I was into athletics. One of the things that happened when I was in Panama that was a national phenomenon that people did not understand a lot about was in the boxing world. Panama had a lot of great boxers. At the time, we had our golden boy, Sugar Ray Leonard, and he fought Roberto Duran. Now, me, with my little analytical self back then, I knew Sugar Ray Leonard was going to get his butt kicked because Sugar Ray Leonard did not know that he was fighting a country. He wasn't fighting Roberto Duran. To them, it was like Panama versus the United States because this was all during that time of the canal transition. And Sugar Ray Leonard went into that fight with a different attitude. And if you remember, anybody remembers that era, Roberto Duran beat him up for 15 rounds.
If we switch back to what your life was like as you grew up in the United States, you're a Panamanian American living in a black neighborhood, Chicago-based black neighborhood, and you do speak another language, you speak Spanish. Mm-hmm. What was it like for you to be Panamanian American in the United States where you grew up?
There were quite a few Hispanics in the Chicago area still. There were quite a few. And even there, they made distinctions amongst themselves. You were either Mexican or Puerto Rican and blah, blah, blah. But there were even class distinctions there. And I was able to intermingle with a lot of them because of the fact that I had a Panamanian culture and background. So living in the Chicago area as a black Hispanic American was It was quite intriguing. I got a lot of opportunities.
In the 1980s, Paul was tapped to work in the administration of the late Harold Washington, Chicago's first black mayor. He says they understood he could work with the residents of Chicago's 95th Street corridor, where African Americans and Latinos live side by side, because he speaks Spanish, is physically African American in appearance and embraces the culture, and is clued into how to adapt to the several Latino cultures of the neighborhood's people.
So I've always been blessed to feel that I was able to cross some of those ethnic cultural lines, because I didn't have any fear of it. It didn't bother me. And as I was growing up, a lot of my friends that didn't have that kind of exposure, there always seemed to be a divide and a hatred between blacks and Hispanics. And a lot of them don't know. I always felt a lot of them didn't know just how close we were. You know, how we were probably more brothers than anything else.
When he thinks about his vantage point for understanding the troubles between the two cultures, Paul says,
but the whole concept of how we are separated culturally as people kind of amazes me and it dismays me at the same time. But you know, I still say that a lot of blacks and Hispanics are a heck of a lot closer than they think.
As he considers who he is and why, the reasons and the nature of the divide that exists between U.S. citizens, Paul's amusement is flavored with irony because of what he knows.
It gets real deep. It gets real deep.
With a look into why culture is important to people in the United States, this has been Vanita Kelly with Lily, Sam, Kimberly, Ellen, Derek, Robert, Jerry, and Paul C. Brown for Why So? Community Voices.
In the Chicago public schools and in urban school districts across the nation, if you're a black male, the odds are against you going to college. And if you do, there's a good chance you won't complete your degree. The college graduation rate for African American males who graduate from Chicago public schools is just a little more than 20%. Community Voices producer Amy Harper takes a look at the forces affecting the life of one young man who's trying to beat those odds.
I met Willie Round in 2010, at the beginning of his freshman year at Central State University. A group of faculty and staff had started a mentoring program for new students. He signed up, and I became his mentor. Willie's from the North Lawndale neighborhood in West Chicago. The poverty rate is high, nearly 40%, and gangs, guns, and drugs are part of everyday life. The streets and drugs took Willie's dad, who died in prison when he was 5, and his uncle was shot not far from where he lives. Recently, he saw police shoot and kill a 16-year-old boy who'd been shooting at them. From the window of his mother's apartment, Willie saw the kid's body jerk as the bullets hit him. When Willie was in grade school, his mom joined the Greater St. John Baptist Bible Church in another part of town. She wanted to get her kids away from the neighborhood and expose them to a different environment and different people.
It kept me active in a lot of things as far as like church trips. It always gave me other things to do besides sitting at home and going out and playing on the streets. It was more like a safe haven, for real.
At Greater St. John, Willie met Reverend Bernard Lilly, the church administrator. He stepped into Willie's life as a mentor, role model, and father figure.
I just seen a student there with so much potential, but wasn't doing so well. But he just needed a push and just needed to be encouraged.
Willie says he wouldn't be where he is today without Reverend Lilly.
I don't know what it was that he seen in me, but I'm glad that he did. I thank God for him every day. Without him, I might not even be alive, for real.
Church-sponsored outings with Reverend Lilly and after-school activities kept Willie busy and off the streets. But the thing that occupied most of his attention was basketball. He knew how to handle a ball, and he got a lot of encouragement to use his athletic skills as a vehicle to a better life. He didn't think seriously about going to college until his senior year, when he transferred to Kelly High School in South Chicago. He'd been recruited by Kelly to play ball, but he found another focus in teacher Brandy Garris's radio and television production class.
So what do they have for the news? Somebody talk to me, Isaac.
I'm in my senior year now, starting to think for myself a little bit more. I didn't see a future in basketball anymore. No, I didn't believe the hype no more.
Brandy Garris is familiar with that hype.
It's a lot of our African-American males feel like basketball and football is the only way they're going to get to college. Once he realized that there was another way to go there, besides that, I think it opened up a whole new world for him. There were about 15 black males that transferred into Kelly the year he did. I think Willie is one of maybe two or three, if I wanted to be optimistic, that is doing something with his life and is in college and continued on.
We gotta make smart the new cool. That's how I feel. Somehow, some way, we gotta flip the script.
Willie's in his third year now at Central State University, majoring in mass communications. In his family and at his church, there's a lot of hope riding on his success.
To see a young man from this community go to a university, graduate with his bachelor's degree, is a success story right there. He just became an odd beater. With him doing that, he's coming back to help his community by that alone, you know, and he can help so many.
The expectations weigh heavily on Willie.
I got family just telling me, like, Lil Will, you are our last hope. It's like they putting their faith in me. Like, nobody ever did that unless it was with basketball. Now y'all expect me to finish college. I never did good ever academically. When I first got into college, I always thought about failing, and that brought a lot of worries. I stressed a lot. I was losing hair, biting my nails every day. You know, I never bit my nails when I was in high school. Oh, yeah, oh, yeah.
Willie's mom, Davita Gill, shares her three-bedroom apartment with five kids, six when Willie's home. Two of them she took in several years ago when their mother, a friend of Davita's, left them and disappeared into the street. A couple of kids' bikes take up space in the small kitchen. It functions as the center of family life in Davita's household. On the day I visited, she was making jerk chicken, one of Willie's favorite dishes. She was making enough to feed friends or family who might drop in for a visit, as often happens.
My house is like a community center. It's quiet now, but kids come from everywhere, and we all hang out and participate.
Willie says Davita's focus on home and family kept him off the streets and out of trouble.
All I knew was my family, and we made time for each other, and we stayed in the house and just chilled with each other. Like, we really didn't have to go outside to have a good time.
Davita works nights for UPS, a part-time job she's held for 18 years. During the day, she cares for her three-year-old grandson while her daughter is working. She manages on just a few hours of sleep. Willie struggles with constant guilt about the debt his mother is taking on to help finance his college education. He doesn't feel he deserves the blessings he's received. She just wants him to stay focused.
We're not going to worry about how it get done. We're just going to worry about doing it and making it better. And I tell him a lot of times, you get unfocused when you're feeling guilty why it's done. Just do it. Do it right. And once that door opens, open another one. Open another one. Open another one.
When he's in Ohio, in school, Willie can see his way through to graduation. He's hopeful about his future. But when he's home for any length of time, it's a different story.
Like, it's like it sucked all of my motivation out, like, within a couple of weeks. Just being around people that don't got no hope.
Last summer, he almost didn't return to college. He didn't want to burden his mother with more debt. And then there were his friends.
I had a lot of people tell me, oh, you can't be from the West Side if you doing this. Like I'm losing some of my hood credibility because I'm doing something better with my life.
They were making money on the street. He was broke all the time. He wondered if maybe this whole college thing was really worth it. Reverend Lilly pushed him hard to return, and he did, at the last minute.
Yeah, they had to pull me back. I mean, I lost sight of my goal. It's easy when you in that type of environment to lose sight of. It's like trying to adapt. Like, I'm trying to constantly adapt back and forth, man. You know, sometimes it just get overwhelming and it's tiring. I'm tired. I'm real tired.
Willie had a dream recently that he finally had a story air on a major TV station in Chicago. Only it was about his death. He'd just been in the wrong place at the wrong time, like a friend of his who was shot and killed last January. He'd just received a recording contract and was about to leave for New York when he died. This summer, Willie received a grant that allows him to stay on campus, to work and attend classes. He says being away from Chicago will help him stay focused on his goals. His plan is to graduate next year and beat the odds.
I know I can't give up. I know I got to keep moving forward because this is something that I have to do. Like, it's no failing. I can't. I don't want to go back to Chicago empty-handed. I don't. I'm ready for the world. I know the pressure's on.
This is Amy Harper for WYSO's Community Voices. and the song you're listening to is Victorious, written and produced by Willie Round.
As victorious, yes, I came from the bottom, but I'm too blessed to be stressed. I came from the bottom, but I'm too blessed to be stressed. Victorious.
This hour, we've heard stories produced in WYSO's 2013 Community Voices training course. This year is a big anniversary for WYSO. It was 55 years ago that three students at Antioch College put this radio station on the air. And we've had an Antioch College student working with us this year, Kijin Higashi Baba. After completing the Community Voices training course, Kijin decided to launch a podcast about her school. It's called The Antioch Word. It'll come out once a month and focus on issues of interest to members of the Antioch College community. But this first episode is the story of the early days of WYSO from one of the station's founders, Ed Richard. Here's Kijin.
Radio at Antioch College started with student experiments that began as early as the 1920s. 2 decades later, there was a station on campus called the Antioch Broadcasting System, or WABS. WABS was an illegal station that transmitted through wires strung between buildings and through steam tunnels on campus. It was the start for many who were interested in careers in broadcasting, including this guy.
You've just crossed over into the Twilight Zone.
That's right. Long before the Twilight Zone television series, Rod Serling was in radio, mainly writing and producing radio plays. The first of his dramas were aired on WABS and another station in Springfield while he was a student at Antioch. When student and founder of WYSO, Ed Richard, arrived on campus in the fall of 1954, WABS was located in one of the towers in Main Hall. Richard admitted that as a first year interested in broadcasting, he'd been a little disappointed in what he'd found at WABS. With a budget of only $1,500 a year, 4 volunteer staff members ran about 6 hours of eclectic programming a day, and nearly every piece of equipment was built by hand. They got the news from a teletype machine, or news ticker. These teletype machines were huge and clunky, and typed out news stories all day automatically. Teletype machines were very loud. Later on, the staff had to keep theirs in a closet lined with blankets to absorb the noise. WABS had obtained the machine from the United Press Agency, who had given it to them in exchange for running commercials.
Pardon me, but we sold our souls to Lucky Strike cigarettes.
Yes, Lucky's are fresher. Or just smoke them and see. Get the better taste you want in a cigarette. And get it fresh. Be happy, go lucky, get better taste today.
That's from a 1950s television commercial.
And we ran Lucky Strike cigarette commercials. They gave us free cigarettes. And in those days, you weren't a radio person, male or female, unless you were chain smoking while you were on the air. So they had pictures of us smoking like mad. We were smoking free cigarettes from Lucky Strike and listening to our news ticker, which was enormously noisy. And that, I think, was the thing that drove Sam Gould over the top.
Sam Gould was the president of Antioch College and had come to Antioch from Boston University, where he had been the director of their radio, television, and theater program. His office was on the floor below the station in Main Hall.
Directly above him was this news ticker pounding away 24 hours a day.
When Richard became the volunteer station manager at WABS in his second year, it was still being transmitted through wires installed by hand throughout campus. At the time, FM radio was fairly new and not very successful. To promote it, the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, announced it would be giving away free call letters and licenses to operate. For Richard Roth and Herndon, this was their chance to make WABS into a legitimate FM station that could expand beyond campus and into the community.
Several of us got together one night in the old cafeteria and said, hey, we need a radio station. And that's sort of how it started. We were tired of crawling through tunnels, repairing wires. We knew we had a station that any day we could be shut down if an FCC van came through and found this illegal station operating.
In May of 1956, the WABS staff proposed the FM station to community council. Feelings on campus were mixed. When the idea was first proposed, the student body seemed mostly indifferent. Members of community council expressed serious doubts about whether a legitimate station was even possible. Richard remembers tackling the cost of the project. It was going to cost $25,000 to get up and running. That would be about $200,000 today. Some doubted the college was big enough to keep a professional station going, especially with the logistical nightmare of coordinating co-ops, training, and programming. Richard and his fellow students were going to hold bake sales and sell records to raise the money, but even then they knew it wouldn't be nearly enough to cover the cost. They found an ally in President Gould, who remained a strong supporter of the students as they worked to get the station on the air. Richard decided to go to the president for help with getting money for the new station.
And he said, what can I do for you? And I said, Dr. Gould, we want a radio station. We know of your background in radio. We think you're the natural person to help us get a radio station. And he looked at me and he sort of laughed and he said, well, that's great, but where are you going to get the money? And I said something like, well, you'll help us get it. And he looked again and he said, well, why do you think you can do this? I said, because we know we can do it. It's going to be not only a college radio station, we're going to include the community. We know that we can pull this off if we had the money. Where are you going to be? Well, we don't know. He said, well, the only thing I want if we do this is for you to be out of Kelly Hall. And I said, yes, I can understand that. We did have some pretty wild parties after broadcast.
President Gould gave Richard the phone number of an old friend in Buffalo, Irving J. Levick. When Richard appealed to him for help, Levick became a major sponsor for the project. Around that time, the college was just finishing construction on a new building that would soon become the Student Union. The campus newspaper, The Record, had just moved in, and Richard negotiated to get some of their space for the radio station.
The Record was not happy with us at all, but we wound up with a corner space. We put the station together for the $25,000. We equipped it. We didn't have enough money for carpet, so we borrowed carpet from other places. I had a professor who had a department store in Springfield, People's Department Store, and I conned him into giving us furniture. Pretty horrible stuff, but it was furniture. And we borrowed stuff. We sort of took stuff when nobody was looking, I would say. We didn't have enough money to soundproof the studios, so we used egg crates.
The space had been prepared, and it was time to apply to the FCC for the construction permit. On the application, the students put down WABS for the call letters of the station.
And we immediately got a call back. No, can't do that. That's taken. We then put down WRVA, Radio Voice of Antioch. That was taken. We went through 15 different call letter combinations, all taken. And out of desperation, I pulled the name YSO out of the air. We're in Yellow Springs, we're a community station, let's call it WYSO. There was no big thinking, it wasn't a dramatic, you know, wow, this is great. It was just sort of a last resort.
The name may have been born out of desperation, but naming the station WYSO for Yellow Springs, Ohio, helped shape the station's identity as a part of both the college and the community surrounding it. There was still one major hurdle to cross. At the time, the FCC required everyone working in radio to be trained and licensed.
Terry and Hal were the technical guys. Without them, it would have been impossible. I was the guy who sort of had to do the money stuff and try to get the programming going and all the things that they didn't want to do, I got stuck with. And one of them was the training program. You do it, Ed. Well, I didn't know how to train. I was an amateur radio guy.
Richard found a connection at the well-established college radio station at Ohio State University, and they sent people down to train students and community members at no cost. The training program served not only to train staff, but to gauge campus interest in the new station. In 1957, 45 newly trained people were added to the staff. And once everyone had their licenses, they began to practice on the old WABS transmitter. Richard and his fellow students spent their time training, developing programming, the program guide, and outlining the mission of this brand new station. In the evening of February 8, 1958, Ed Richard put the station on the air.
Good evening. At this time, Antioch College begins its first official transmission on FM. This is station WYSO, owned and operated by Antioch College, Yellow Springs, Ohio, with studios and transmitter on the campus of Antioch College, operating on a frequency of 91.5 megacycles by authority of the Federal Communications Commission. For its first program, the Antioch Broadcasting System will bring you the official opening and formal dedication of its facilities in the Antioch Union.
They had done it. WYSO was a fully licensed and trained radio station. For the next few years, WYSO aired 30 hours of carefully developed programming a week. Richard looks back on the challenges he, Roth, and Herndon faced trying to get the station started among the constant doubts.
WYSO was the thing that kept us going. And somehow, these dreams turned into incredible realities.
That was the first episode of The Antioch Word, a new podcast for the Antioch College community. You can subscribe at yso.org. There'll be a new episode every month. This has been part two of the 2013 Community Voices special. Hear the first hour of our special at yso.org, where you can find more information about our training course, listen to stories from all our Community Voices producers, and more. That's wyso.org, and click the Community Voices tab. We'll be at the Film Dayton Festival next weekend for a special screenless screening. It's just like going to the movies, except without the pictures. That's at 11 a.m. on Saturday, August 24th at the Neon Movie Theater. Thanks for tuning in tonight. For WYSO Community Voices, I'm Sarah Buckingham.